Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
51551 for your messages now. Best-selling author Matt Haig moved us all with The Midnight Library. It's a wonderful novel about a woman. She was on the brink of ending her life, and but it's a fabulous, lovely bit of fantasy that warmed your soul. And he's back with a new story. This time it's set in Greece, I suppose I would say, and also set in Ibiza. It's a place he has a ferociously complicated connection with. The Life Impossible. It's a hotly anticipated new release. Matt Haig is on the line. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Oliver. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Delighted that you could chat to us. Let's start with Ibiza, will we? Because that's a major character in the story, really. Can you tell us about this island and the real island in contrast to, I suppose, the false impressions that we mostly have of the place?
Yeah, well, I've known both sides of it because back in the 90s, when I was a young, foolish man, I was the typical cliche of drinking drugs and hedonism and all of that stuff, and it ended up with me having a breakdown in 1999. And I wrote about all this in a memoir years ago, and it's only recently that I dared come back to the sort of like place where I was at my most mentally unwell and sort of revisit it. And I found a completely different place, probably because I'm a sort of completely different person now in a different stage of life. And yeah, I mean, the thing people don't necessarily know about Ibiza is it can be a very quiet place. It can be a place of nature, a place of sort of flamingos on salt lakes and hill walks and pine forests, as well as obviously the nightclubs and the sunset bars and all of that stuff. But it's one of those places that was whatever you want it to be. And it was the inspiration for this book. And it got me got me into writing again, because after The Midnight Library, I was... I had a kind of year off where I didn't really know if I had any more in the tank and whether I wanted to write again and all of that. But this, so it was the place really that brought me back, and that's how The Life Impossible sort of came to be.
The Midnight Library, were you 10 novels, 10 books in at that stage? And it was an overwhelming success. Was it the success that was the issue for your head?
About a little bit, but I mean, you don't ever want to moan about that, because obviously it's the thing you've sort of wanted, and no one likes to hear anyone moan about that. But I think it was more that, that coincided, you know, it's the start of the pandemic when that came out, 2021. There was a lot of life stuff going on. My dad was ill. My mum had just had heart surgery, and there was all kinds of things. And, you know, when people sort of like from a distance think, oh, well, you should be so happy, or, you know, you've got this, you've got what you wanted. And then that disconnect between how you feel on the inside. And for the first time in my life, actually, it was during this patch that I had therapy, which I should have probably had 20 years before. But, you know, typical young man wanting to sort of like deny problems when I was younger. And it took me a long time to get to the point where I thought, no, you know, I was drinking again, you see. So I thought, no, I need to knock this on the head. And I had therapy at that point. And it was a bit ironic, because after I wrote a book called Reasons to Stay Alive, people were thinking, you know, they'd introduce you as a sort of mental health activist or mental health ambassador. But I think that role was a bit difficult for me, because I was thinking, well, my own mental health right now is not 100%. And yet people are looking to me for advice. So that was tricky. It just felt a lot, I suppose. It felt a lot of different things at that time, and I needed to sort that out.
Is it fair to say that you had it was a mental health struggle rather than an addiction recovery? Because going back drinking, you probably felt safe to go back drinking because you weren't. You didn't have addiction issues per se.
Yeah, and it wasn't daily drinking. I was just, you know, it's a typical Northern European binge drinking kind of thing that I had, you know, Saturday nights with a gin bottle, and, you know, it was something I could pretend wasn't a problem, but it was increasingly a problem. And there'd been the last tour, I'm on a book tour at the moment where I'm stone cold sober, and I haven't drank for 3 years, actually. But the last tour, I'd always sort of need a little shot of something to get me on stage, and it was my crutch for a little while. So I thought, you know, that's an issue. So I just decided to address that.
Okay. As I say, Ibiza, a huge central part of this story and of your story as well. So when you talk about going back to Ibiza, did you write some of this novel there, or what? How close a connection is there?
Yeah, no, definitely. I've been back and forth a few times, actually, about five or six times over the last 2 years. And what's really, I think, obviously it's very busy at times like this, but a great time to visit Ibiza is the in-between times, you know, the half season, when it's like September, October, or April, May, where there's enough things open so you can go out to a restaurant and stuff, but it you know, the quiet side of the island is there. Yeah. And it's like a natural filter when you visit a place like that out of season, because all the good stuff stays open. And, it's a great island. And I didn't think I'd ever go back there, because obviously I'd been suicidal there and when I was like 24 years old. And to go back was, it was quite a cathartic, therapeutic experience.
What a moment, because you actually visit the very spot where you're at the lowest point of your illness, aren't you?
Yeah, I visited the cliffs, basically. I visited the place I nearly died, and also walked past the medical centre where I was sent to and prescribed industrial loads of diazepam just to get a flight home, you know. And so it was all kind of like reliving a lot of traumatic stuff. It was all, you know, self-inflicted stuff, but nevertheless, it was traumatic stuff that I'd gone through. And, that was quite intense. But at the same time, because over two decades had passed, there was also that distance to it. And also, I think the island has changed a lot too, which helped. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's easy to blame the place. It's easy to say, well, you know, if I escape Ibiza and never go back there, then I'm fine. And obviously that's not the case.
Sure.
It's a person rather than the place.
Was the moment, you said it was kind of traumatic, was it challenging to kind of visit those exact locations where the other Matt Haig had reached the brink all those years ago?
Yeah, no, it was. The overriding feeling I can remember of being at my lowest point was I was in this beautiful place. I was looking out at the Mediterranean and literally the most beautiful view I'd ever seen, and yet I'd never felt so bad. So that added to the sense of like helplessness, and it made me understand what depression is. It doesn't matter what you're looking at. It doesn't matter where you are. It's what's going on inside. And I literally remember thinking if I stayed alive, I'd never be able to enjoy or appreciate that view again. So to go back to actually disprove depression and prove depression wrong and actually enjoy the sight of the ocean and the sunset and to actually see all that, that was quite a powerful thing, yeah.
Gorgeous moment of survival. What would you say was the kind of key to healing yourself?
I think with depression, there wasn't for me any quick fixes or magic buttons. You know, it really was a case of time, and it was a case of realizing that a lot of the stuff depression gives you is, you know, it's lies. You know, you've given a very, very, one of the main symptoms is you're given this incredibly pessimistic worldview. I was convinced I wouldn't be here at the age of 25. I'm now at the fine age of 49 and staring 50 in the eye, and I'm still here. I'm very pleased to be getting older and very grateful to be getting older. And I think really that oldest cliche in the world about time healing is kind of true, but it's very hard to see when you're in the moment. So you sort of need other people who've been there to actually understand what you're feeling and to have that perspective. And I think, you know, I'm incredibly grateful that I had supportive parents at the time. I had a partner who's understanding. You know, it's a very lonely thing, depression, and it doesn't matter who you've got around you, but it does actually help to have someone you can talk to and externalise your problems. So, you know, there's some things in life we can't handle by ourselves, and it's important to reach out.
But you're overcoming and surviving, which is great. And The Life Impossible, it doesn't deal with the same topics as Midnight Library. It deals a lot with grief, though, doesn't it? And it goes down the surreal path to deal with grief.
Yes, it's a fantasy story. It's a fable. It's about grief, but it's about guilt. It's about regret. So there's a little overlap with The Midnight Library, but it's about how at any point in life, you know, you can start again. The central character in this novel is a lot older. She's 72 years old, retired teacher, grieving widow. So she feels life's behind her, and she discovers it isn't, and it's a fable. So a lot of very unrealistic things happen in this book, but it's For me, it's about that feeling of recovering from something, whether it's depression, whether it's grief, whether it's whatever it is, whatever traumatic things happen. It's about that surreal feeling when you feel like you can't embrace the world again, but suddenly you can, and you can appreciate music, you can appreciate people, you can appreciate food, or even a glass of orange juice, whatever it is, you're back in the world again.
It's like it's your trademark now at this stage, isn't it? You put in surreal, a bit of fantasy, but it's always grounded in the reality. And
I think so. I think we're all inhabiting our own realities anyway at the moment.
That's true.
So
that's for sure. Yeah.
Especially with the politics and everything. So I think I think it's increasingly harder to find to be a realistic writer. I think it's almost more realistic to just sort of like write down your daydreams and to actually understand your own sort of like imagination rather than to try and work out what this shared reality is. But I have fun with it. I get very bored if I'm writing like three very realistic chapters. I suddenly want to add a ghost or an alien or a mysterious something happening, yes.
Because some of the characters essentially get superpowers, but they, we find the true power is just being themselves, isn't it? It's kind of it's therapy talking in a creative way. I'm assuming.
Yeah, and I've written a lot of books now, as you said, and I've never had more fun writing this one. I have no idea how readers are going to react to it, but in terms of me writing it, I enjoyed writing it and going on holiday to Spain by writing it. And I just had fun with it, really.
Yeah. You recently got a diagnosis of ADHD and autism, is that right? Was that helpful to you?
Yeah, well, it was on the back of the therapy. The therapist was noticing things that were coming up increasingly in the conversations we were having. And so he referred me to a psychiatrist and I got a diagnosis. But it's a very weird thing at the fine old age, when you're in your late 40s, I was 46 at the time, getting that diagnosis, because it's bittersweet. Because I can remember at school, in some subjects, I was considered special needs. They'd just say, you're special needs, and they wouldn't tell you what those needs were. They wouldn't tell you what special meant. So there was always this kind of mystery of why I sort of like occasionally sort of shut down or sort of like looked vacant or stared out of windows and stuff. And it was just basically overload and not having the right brain for it. And it's made me be kinder with myself. Also, knowing the ADHD stuff has given me pause. It certainly helped with the not drinking. I just realised a lot of that behaviour was just sort of like impulsive.
Yeah. Okay.
And I don't argue with people on the internet anymore, which is something I used to get into trouble for doing. And so I'm a little bit more, it's made me feel a little bit more grown up and a little bit more restrained, shall we say.
You're aware of the lovely glitches in the brain and use them well instead of letting them take control of you.
Yeah, exactly. I'm accepting of my difference now and understanding it. And also, it's not, obviously, everyone has different perspectives and prejudices on it, and there's a debate about underdiagnosis or overdiagnosis and all of that. But for me, it's just helped me understand the differences. I don't wake up in the morning and think, oh, I'm an autistic person or I've got ADHD. In certain situations, I think, that's perhaps due to being wired a little differently.
Now, a couple of years ago, you mentioned that you were learning how to play the piano again with your son, who was very good at the piano, I believe. How's that been going? Did you keep it going?
I kept it going a little bit, but it got me through the pandemic. As a kid, I was one of those kids. My mum was very good. She sent me to piano lessons, but at the age of 11, I discovered it wasn't a cool thing for a boy in my school. And as I say, I had undiagnosed autism, so I wasn't fitting in anyway. No. And then having the piano lessons on top, that was not going down well with the boys on the sports field. So I gave it up at a young age. I got back into it during COVID, and there's a lot of apps now which are really good, and I find it really good and calming and really good to focus on things. I am still doing it, but I'm also learning Spanish, which is sort of filling that gap of having something to focus on. I'm not very good at it at all, but I thought, now I've written a book set in Spain and it's coming out in Spain as well, I've got to try at least to have some basic understanding.
So the target is to tinkle at the piano and sing a full song in Spanish.
In Spanish,
that's the whole thing. Okay.
Julio Iglesias, here we go. Yes,
Very good. Listen, Matt Haig, thank you so much. The Life Impossible is available in all the good bookshops and online now. I love how generous you are in interviews and giving of yourself. So thank you so much for that. I hope it helps and doesn't hinder your health, by the way.
No, not at all. Not at all. It was lovely to chat to you, Oliver. Thank you.
A pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much, Matt Haig. And I just want to say as well to people listening to that, that if you've been affected at all by any of the matters, supports are available on rte.ie/helplines. If you don't have the internet, of course, you can just go straight on the phone. The Samaritans have a 24-hour listening service on 116123. That's really good. Non-judgmental listening. 116123. But the Life Impossible, Matt Haig, is out now. We're going to talk to Kevin McGarren. We'll have a quick break first.
Email oliver@rte.ie.